Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 100 days have passed since the United States began bombing in Libya, but President Obama still does not have congressional approval for the operation. The House last week rejected a bill authorizing the action. The Senate is debating the issue today. The White House says it would welcome an authorization, but doesn't really need it. Many members of Congress disagree. This hour on Point, America's involvement in Libya and the debate over presidential war powers. You can join the conversation. Should Congress have a say in whether the U.S. should be going after Muammar Gaddafi? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me first from Washington is Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, Tom.
So, Nancy, 100 days. Where do things stand? Muammar Gaddafi is now facing an indictment from the International Criminal Court. He is said to be looking for a place for a refuge outside Tripoli, but he is not yet ready to leave Libya. Where do things stand in the war right now, Nancy?
Well, it's interesting. Internationally, we're starting to see some real concern from NATO partners about the direction of the war. Britain came out and said that they don't think they can sustain their efforts past September. The Italians expressed concern. And so we're seeing this ongoing effort of limiting Gaddafi's air power and efforts at eliminating his regime. But so far, it hasn't led to the kind of immediate rapid change that many had expected when this operation began 100 days ago. And so what you're seeing is the rebels trying to hold on to the grounds that they've gained. Interestingly, they have less ground now than they did 100 days ago. And NATO trying to find its place in this conflict that it never anticipated would go this long.
The rebels have less ground. They're actually losing ground. I thought the rebels had been making a little bit of progress.
They have, but if you look at how much land they had, especially in the east, compared to where they were when this began, remember, they had all the way to Bin Jued when the operation began, and now they're not able to take Brega, which is about 100 kilometers east of Bin Jued. And so in Misrata, where we've talked a lot about the fighting there, they still haven't been able to take over there. The most gains have happened in the west in the mountains near the Tunisian border.
Right.
But overall, it's interesting for all this promise and hope of the rebels taking over. Overall, they have less ground than they did 100 days ago.
And, of course, President Obama said this operation was going to last days, not weeks. Well, we're past days, we're past weeks, we're into months now. Any sense of how long this is? I mean, this sounds like this could continue indefinitely.
That's right. And not only that, but I think there's a growing sense that this won't end militarily, but in fact will end when Gaddafi runs out of money to finance his war effort, that the international community isn't ready to invest militarily for the regime change that it wants. And so you have a gap, right, between what the international community wants to happen, the end of the regime, and the military resources it's assigned to it, which is basically to limit his air power. And so what that, I think, portends of is a prolonged conflict that ultimately ends when Gaddafi runs out of money or the international community increases its military effort, which, of course, is seeming less and less likely by the day.
Okay, Nancy, and quickly bring us up to date on the situation in Congress. It appears that this operation is not going to be defunded, but the issue of whether there should be an authorization is still being debated.
That's right. Well, there are two things happening today. We're going to see a Senate debate on the War Powers Act, and also the markup of the Kerry McCain Act, which essentially allows for support of this operation for a year. Which is interesting because, as you'll recall, Senator McCain visited Libya and expressed his wholehearted support, but now there appears to be a condition on it of a year. And I think what you're ultimately seeing is the political frustration with essentially a failed military effort.
Right. Good. All right. Thanks so much, Nancy. Good talking to you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Nancy Youssef is Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. She spoke to me from Washington. And we are going to focus on that issue today of how the country should decide whether and when to go to war. Many members of Congress do feel strongly about the issue. Republican Tom Rooney from Florida authored that bill to defund U.S. operations in Libya. In explaining the bill last week, he referred to the Constitution and what he said the founding fathers believed about war powers.
They wanted us to have this deliberation, this debate that we're having here today, arguments that have been made on both sides that have been very good. Because the last thing that we want as Americans is for some president, whether it's this president or some future president, to be able to pick fights around the world without any debate from another branch of government.
Picking fights without any debate from another branch of government, that's the question. And joining me now in the studio is Jack Goldsmith, professor at Harvard Law School and Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel from 2003 under George W. Bush. He was also before that special counsel in the Department of Defense, and he's the author of The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. He writes for the blog Lawfare. And from New York, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He writes a weekly column for CNN.com. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Hello, gentlemen, and welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First, Jack, the longer this war goes on, the more muddled the mission, the more controversial this operation becomes. The original War Powers Resolution was passed in 1973 towards the end of another unpopular military operation, the war in Vietnam. Does the War Powers issue only come up with reference to unpopular military engagements?
Well, the politics tend which are behind the control of the presidency in war tend to come up in unpopular military operations. And Congress tends to get involved and get exercised in unpopular military operations. But, of course, the War Powers Resolution purports to apply to popular and unpopular wars alike.
And, Julian, you would say that it's appropriate, I think, to consider the war powers issue precisely when wars are unpopular because it just underscores that wars deserve, the decision to go to war deserves to be debated.
Absolutely. I mean, Congress does a lot of things poorly, but one of its functions that's often worked is to raise concern and to offer a forum for debate when wars are unpopular. I mean, the problem is we do it late and once troops are in combat. But I think there is a reason we have this power that Congress exercises. And from Vietnam onwards, that's been the place where presidents have been challenged and where there's been some room for the public to voice skepticism about what's going on.
Well, give us a real quick history of how this issue has played out over the years, how this debate over war powers has developed.
Well, I mean, it hasn't been followed very well. Again, as you mentioned, this was passed in the aftermath or toward the end of Vietnam. It was a congressional act of frustration with both Presidents Johnson and Nixon about excessive executive power. And it was a compromise passed in 1973, placing some kind of check on what the president could do without Congress and when the president had to seek some kind of approval. Presidents have stretched this, though, as much as possible. They have sent troops into combat. They have often asked for, you know, the minimal requirements from Congress. And it's often been challenged in the courts that presidents aren't following the War Powers Resolution, and the courts have sided with the executive. You know, many say this is a new step, what President Obama is doing, simply leaving the troops there and not asking for any authorization after the deadline has passed. So I think this is a culmination of several decades where Congress and the president haven't taken the War Powers Resolution seriously. And I think the threat people see is that this will totally render it irrelevant.
Jack, you've got a copy of the War Powers Resolution there in front of you. I think that you have written that this resolution is not the ideal definition of war powers. What do you think makes more sense?
Well, the War Powers Resolution of 1973 is famously full of holes. And one of the things that it does is it essentially allows the president, gives him 60 days to use force, basically carte blanche. And its main requirement and its most important requirement is that the president has that 60-day period to come and get approval from Congress before he continues in the war. So it's meant to give the president flexibility in using force on his own, but it's also meant to encourage him to go to Congress to make sure he gets the support. I agree with Julian that this is the culmination, what's going on in Libya, of a long-term trend, but it's important to realize why this is something new and why it is a fateful step, because this is the first war in which the president has clearly exceeded that 60-day limit. And that's why the fate of the War Powers Resolution hangs in the balance here, and it might be the death knell for it in this case.
Because even though other presidents have ignored the War Powers Resolution, they have asked for authorization earlier.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't even say that they had ignored the War Powers Resolution. Every president, every time he uses force abroad, reports to Congress consistent with the War Powers Resolution. And no president has clearly exceeded the 60-day limit without getting authorization. So I think it's a little bit misleading to say that presidents have ignored it. They actually take it somewhat seriously.
Even they don't like it.
They don't like it, exactly.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the debate over authorizing President Obama's intervention in Libya and about presidential power. And we've actually gotten some comments already from listeners online. Corey writes, Congress would not keep us there, nor would the American people. This presidential abuse really needs to be stopped. No more undeclared wars begun at the whim of a president alone. And Brian, in the same vein, says the way things work is pretty simple. He's actually interested in the politics of this debate. He says if the president is of your party, he can do whatever he wants, whenever, without question. If he's of the other party, Congress must be involved, checks and balances, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not entirely true because we've seen a number of Democrats actually upset that President Obama did not go to Congress for authorization. Julian Zelizer in New York, you mentioned before the break that the Supreme Court has so far opted not to get into this debate. Is that because, in your judgment, it doesn't really seem all that clear who really has war-making authority under the Constitution? What do you think is the meaning, the significance of the court's reluctance to get involved in this debate?
Well, I mean, Jack could probably talk more about the courts. I know there's been several challenges since the 80s, including one during the first Persian Gulf War, where the members of Congress challenging the president saying that they had flouted the War Powers Resolution for various reasons were knocked down. I think politically, though, it's difficult. I mean, the expansion of executive power is something that has been a bipartisan power, including on war making. This was the chief complaint of Democrats and some Republicans and members of the administration during the Bush era. And so I do think it's hard politically for one president, one party to attack another on this issue. Again, I think we're seeing a step where a president is ignoring the War Powers Resolution more than others. But I do think the spirit of the original resolution has not been followed. And I think there's just many examples that people can point to, from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton, where Congress was not fully consulted. And so politically, it's very hard. The courts have various reasons where these suits have been rejected that, again, I think Jack could speak better to.
Well, Jack, you are a constitutional lawyer. You teach at Harvard Law School, and you've got experience in government with precisely these kind of issues. Looking at the Constitution, what's your judgment of what the Founding Fathers actually wanted, and how do you explain the reluctance of the Supreme Court to adjudicate here?
So there's actually a big debate about precisely what the Founding Fathers wanted in terms of the war powers, but it's pretty clear that they thought that the president would need to get the permission of Congress for any large-scale military effort abroad, although the reasons for that are a little bit uncertain. One way that the framers of the Constitution thought that presidential war powers would be controlled is through the absence of a standing army. If you didn't have a standing army, there would be nothing for the president to use to make war. And, of course, now we have a huge standing army. Over time, though, that original understanding of the Constitution has changed as the United States' position in the world has changed, as the nature of the presidency has changed. And presidents have dozens and dozens of times since the founding used force abroad without congressional authorization. So many people think that the constitutional issue and the constitutional limits on starting a war, as opposed to the limits of the War Powers Resolution, that the limits on starting a war have changed over time. Now, the truth is there's no definitive resolution of the constitutional issue because, as you say, courts have basically stayed out of it. And there are a lot of sort of technical legal reasons why they've stayed out of it. But the basic reason is that they viewed it as what they call a political question. And that means essentially that the courts think that this is an issue, a constitutional issue, that the political branches need to work out. And that in turn means that only Congress can protect its constitutional prerogatives here by standing up to the presidency. And, you know, they tend not to do that for a lot of complicated reasons.
Now, Jack, you served, I'm going to put you on the spot here, you served in the Bush administration. True, President Bush went to Congress for approval of action in Iraq. But did he know ahead of time that he was going to get that? And would he have been willing to do it if he had, if he was dealing with a Democratic-controlled Congress where there was a lot of opposition? Would he have been as willing to go into that?
Well, there's a political question and a legal question. I don't know the answer to what he would have done. Politically, it would have been deeply imprudent for him to go into Iraq or to fight against al-Qaeda without getting Congress on board. And so I think that the overwhelming imperative would have been to do that, and that's, in fact, what they did. Legally, there are actually opinions from the Law Office of Legal Counsel during the Bush administration, not ones that I wrote, but there are opinions in the Office of Legal Counsel that said that he could use force without going to Congress. So legally, that definitely would have been the Bush administration position.
All right, let's listen to one more clip of tape from another member of Congress. This is Republican Jason Chaffetz, who is from Utah. He was speaking to C-SPAN's Washington Journal earlier this month about his vote to remove troops from Libya.
Take the case of Libya. This is a civil war in North Africa. Quite frankly, we should not be using our military force there the way that we are. And if the president wants to make the case that we should, then he should come to the United States Congress for that authorization. For him to stand up before the world and say that he got authorization from the United Nations is offensive to a lot of us.
Julian Zelizer, interesting point. Congressman Chaffetz points to the president's reference to the United Nations as authorizing this operation. We've actually seen a number of military operations going all the way back to the Korean conflict that have been authorized by the United Nations. Is the United Nations sort of taking over some of the jurisdiction that the Founding Fathers may have thought was going to go to the U.S. Congress?
Well, yes. I mean, there's been two criticisms. One is that since 1950, Congress doesn't declare war, and it's not asked to declare war, and presidents have usurped that power. And the second is that the United States increasingly has relied on the UN and kind of international alliances to make decisions about when American troops and American technology should be used abroad. It's the same criticism. I would add, though, that Congress has often been complicit in this. They're often willing to go along either with operations through the UN or NATO or that the president launches because politically they don't want to challenge that in the initial decision-making moment. And it's also convenient because if things go well, they have cover, but if things go badly, they can always come back and attack the president later. So you often hear this criticism, but you don't hear it at the start. You hear much more of it months into an operation. And so part of the problem is with Congress. It's not just with the president.
That's actually a really good point. I want to go now to some of our listeners. We're having, there's a lot of strong feelings on the part of our listeners about this issue. Philip, for example, is calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Philip, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I think a lot of your commentators are still kind of using a 19th century frame of reference for combat. I mean, Congress has been unable to adapt to some of this changing warfare and tactics, and maybe that's why the executive has taken so much power here. I mean, we have, like, droid combat, automated combat, cyber combat. And if I could add one more thing, I think Russia, North Korea, and China have already declared war on U.S. banks and the Pentagon and our security systems already.
Through cyberspace, you mean?
There's not a debate for that going on.
Right. Jack, you've actually written about how maybe this debate is a little bit anachronistic, or certainly when President Obama says we're not engaged in hostilities in Libya and therefore he's not subject to the War Powers Resolution, we're really talking here about changes in the way wars are fought, right?
Yes, we are. And one innovation of the Obama administration in justifying what it's doing is it basically says by using drones, by firing missiles from a distance, we're not putting American troops in harm's way. We're not creating a situation that Congress can't remove troops. And that was the real purpose of the War Powers Resolution. So the changing technology of war, it claims, in effect gives it a way around the War Powers Resolution. Now, I should say I don't think that argument is very persuasive, but there is no doubt that warfare is changing and that the War Powers Resolution had a different type of warfare in mind.
Well, how would you define hostilities at this point? I think one of the points that the State Department's legal advisor Harold Koh is making is that U.S. troops are effectively not really in harm's way in Libya.
Well, it's true that they're not really in harm's way. We actually have pilots doing overflight operations still, but their air defenses are destroyed. So it's definitely true that American troops are not very much in harm's way. I don't think that's the definition of hostilities. What you have here is a UN-sponsored use of force. You've got massive bombardments of Libya, both by the United States and by the United Nations, which technically a U.S. admiral is in charge of leading. You've got 75% or so of all the support operations being done by the United States, and you have a lot of people on the ground being killed. So I don't think it's plausible to say that we're not in hostilities under the War Powers Resolution.
Let's go now to Karen, who is calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Karen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm just wondering how much of this shows President Obama's resistance to the War Powers Act and how much is it just sort of an arrogance or a dismissal of the influence of Congress and therefore the American people. It sounds to me as if he could care less about what anybody else thinks about this. He decided to support the UN action on his own. And if that's true, if he feels that he doesn't need, you know, the agreement or the support of the American people, then what does that mean, calling to question, you know, every time we have an election about what kinds of things future presidents could get us involved in? I think we'll have to look a lot more closely at candidates and their what they're willing to go fight for. I'd like to listen to the comments off the air, if that's okay.
Yeah. Okay, Julian Zelizer, I mean, we all remember that President Obama, when he was Senator Obama, talked about the need for members of Congress to have backbone to stand up to the executive branch when it comes to war-making decisions. How do you explain the position that he's had as far as the Libya intervention?
Well, look, I think there's a discrepancy with what he said and what he does as president. I don't think that's unique to him. I think there is a temptation when you're in the White House. There are certain foreign policy initiatives that a president wants to take. Some are urgent and immediate. Others in Libya, I think, are more a decision about where to deploy American force. And Congress, by nature, is slow, it's inefficient, and it could be extraordinarily frustrating as an institution. And in this day and age, the polarization is so intense, it's hard to get a decision quickly and efficiently. So there is a temptation as a president, ultimately, to ignore the legislative branch when possible. It's much harder to do on domestic policy, a lot easier to do on foreign policy. So I think he succumbs to the same kind of temptation that anyone in that White House does. And I do think there is a discomfort with Congress. I would just add that the same arguments about warfare, by the way, today with drones and high technology were made back in the 60s and 70s. Once we were in the age of nuclear war, that was the same justification for presidents having to act quickly, that in an age of nuclear bombs and intercontinental missiles, we couldn't depend on this institution that is so slow. So there's a basic question about how these two branches of government work and how much are we willing to invest in protecting a more deliberative and also slower institution, namely Congress, as part of this decision-making process.
Well, Julian, you're a historian. Wasn't there even some debate in the World War II about how quickly Congress was willing to move on a declaration of war?
Absolutely, and the, you know, forces of isolationism had been very strong in the 1930s, frustrated Franklin Roosevelt, who circumvented them and ultimately worked to build support for a declaration of war, and ultimately, obviously, Pearl Harbor changed the politics. But in that case, you know, President Roosevelt worked very hard to build public opinion and put pressure on Congress to support a more internationalist agenda. That ultimately is a function of having to get Congress to approve this. It forces the president to make his or down the line her case about the war. And I think that's what defenders of Congress say. When we lose that, the president doesn't even have to try to do that, doesn't have to try to build public opinion. There's too much freedom to make that initial step of using force without having to do that. And then mistakes can be made or very unpopular decisions can happen.
Well, let's hear now from Thomas, who's calling from Chapmansboro, Tennessee. Hello, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
I just wanted to I think the debate doesn't center around whether the War Powers Act is being followed or not, but rather the legitimacy of the War Powers Act itself. It seems to overstep the constitutional setup that the president is the commander-in-chief and that the power the legislator, Congress, has over any sort of war, any sort of military action is the power of the purse. The War Powers Act kind of oversteps the president's actions, the president's role as commander-in-chief of military forces, and rather it should be a focus on that power of the purse to fund or defund the war efforts of the president.
Jack Goldsmith?
Well, that's a view that many people hold. Many presidentialists believe that not only is the War Powers Resolution suggestion of consultation unconstitutional, but even the 60-day limit is an invalid intrusion on the president's power. And I don't think that's right. I think that Congress has exercised control over the presidency during war and in ending wars and at the beginning of wars since the beginning of the country. It hasn't always done so through the spending power. But it is a question of debate, and it's an open question. And as we said earlier, courts have not resolved it. And until they do, it's going to continue to be a matter of debate.
Well, what's the best argument, even leaving aside the intention of the Founding Fathers, which is apparently unclear? In your judgment, what's the best argument for why Congress should be in on this decision? Ultimately, the president is the commander-in-chief.
The president is the commander-in-chief, but that really was designed, that power was meant to for the president to be able to control forces during war and not necessarily to begin the war. The reasons that Congress should be involved, and it's a matter of political prudence, if not constitutional requirement, are the reasons that Julian suggested, which is that Congress has a different perspective. Over time, the president cannot engage in military conflicts without the political and ultimately the financial support of the Congress. Presidents ask for trouble and get into trouble when they use force abroad for an extended period of time without congressional approval. And he could have gotten it at the beginning. And Julian is right that he may not have been able to get it day one when he made that decision on a Tuesday night to go into Libya. But certainly in the first few weeks, he could have gone to Congress and gotten its support. It would have been a battle. It would have been a fight of the type the administration doesn't like, but they could have gotten the support.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the debate over authorizing President Obama's intervention in Libya and about presidential power generally. We're talking with Jack Goldsmith, professor at Harvard Law School, and he served in the Bush administration in the Office of Legal Counsel and before that in the Department of Defense. Also with us is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. But joining me now from Washington is Congressman Jim Moran, a Democrat from Virginia. And on Friday, he voted for the bill before the House authorizing military involvement in Libya. That's the bill that did not pass. Congressman Moran, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
So I have I'd like to ask you how you felt, how you voted on the authorizations for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan when they came down from President George W. Bush.
I voted no on Iraq consistently. I supported the Afghan mission up until recently.
So you felt, by voting no, you obviously felt then that Congress had a legitimate say in whether those operations should go forward, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Congress should have a legitimate say, and but each situation, I do think, requires some specific judgment. There's nothing cookie-cutter, and there's no cookie-cutter policy that should apply to any of these situations, although the history obviously should guide the future. That in Iraq, I strongly opposed it because I was convinced that Iran could be the only ultimate victor of that conflict. In Afghanistan, I thought it was appropriate to go after the havens for al-Qaeda, but that's not what we're doing now, and so I've changed my position on that. In Libya, I do think that it is appropriate for the United States to be doing what it is doing in support of a NATO mission, and I don't agree with Mr. Professor Goldsmith on the requirement for the War Powers Act, and I think some of his argument actually is somewhat inconsistent with his service under the Bush administration. But putting that aside, I just don't agree with his conclusion that this is not a appropriate or authorized military mission.
Well, I'll put that question to Jack Goldsmith in a minute, but I just want to clarify. Do you think then that President Obama did not need the authorization of Congress, did not need to go to Congress for approval of the intervention in Libya? Leaving aside the merits of the decision to intervene in Libya, what do you think he should have done or needed to do with respect to Congress?
He certainly needed to notify Congress, which he did immediately. And he did so not only in the context of what was happening on the ground, but also in the context of who was asking us to be involved, and made it clear that this will be a NATO-led mission. And that still is what it is. I think the Congress certainly should debate the issue. But having been in the Congress for 20 years, I think debate is far more appropriate in most circumstances than reaching any ultimate conclusion, because I don't have the confidence that the Congress is going to ask, is going to resolve these issues in ways that transcend politics. Unfortunately, their conclusions are more often based on politics than good policy.
Well, Congressman Moran, I think I heard you say that we should not have a what you called a cookie-cutter approach to this issue of when and whether presidents should consult with Congress or get congressional approval before going to war. What is the why shouldn't there be a consistent principle in that regard?
There should be. I wish there were. But the president's ultimate responsibility is the security of the country, and acting in a way that is consistent with the leadership of the world, frankly, in terms of military capability and foreign policy. In this case, the mission is sufficiently limited. Our exposure is sufficiently limited. There will be no escalation to the point of boots on the grounds. And I think the means that we are using to support NATO's mission are entirely appropriate. If we were not doing that, the mission could well fail, and the consequences, I think, are sufficiently adverse that it justifies what the president has done to date. And I think it's important that we see this mission through in support of the Transitional Council in Libya, and which is consistent with our values and principles. And if that were not the case, then my judgment would be different.
Congressman, if you keep stay on the line for a second, I'd like to go now to Jim, a listener who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Jim, welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, taking my call. Love your show.
Thanks.
My comment is, and I think your guest just answered it, is this is supposed to be a NATO-led expedition, I mean, the U.S. is the majority benefactor of NATO. Shouldn't that right there say we should be involved? The question I have is, shouldn't Congress be debating whether we should be involved in NATO at all, seeming how nowadays NATO seems more like a paper tiger than an actual force to be reckoned with? I can, of course, take my call offline.
Okay. Congressman Rand, George Will, the columnist, wrote, I think it was last week, that he thinks NATO has become a Potemkin alliance. It sort of provides the appearance of alliance, but it's not really there when you need it. What do you think about that issue?
Both Jim and George are right. NATO has virtually no logistical capability. NATO is going to be little more than feckless unless they have American military support. Bear in mind, we have made our military capability a priority. They have not. They don't like to engage in combat where any lives might be put at risk. They put a small share of their budget into their military capability, and they rely upon the United States to be the policeman of the world. And we will continue to have to play that role, which someone has to play, until we give them sufficient responsibility, until we give them sufficient leadership, and until we back them up when they do take initiative. They have taken initiative here. They should have. And as long as we defer to them in terms of how to use force and who should take the lead and who we should support and for what reasons, I mean, that's going to strengthen NATO. Well, you know, the president was criticized for suggesting, or it wasn't the president, but some in his National Security Council, apparently, that suggested we will lead from behind to something to that extent. But that's basically what we have to do with NATO. We have to give them sufficient support until they can develop the strength and the resilience and the commitment that we desperately need. If NATO didn't exist today, we'd have to create them. And it's very much in our interest to let this be a NATO mission, as ultimately it was in the Balkans. But when NATO was doing it on their own, they didn't do it. It was only when President Clinton took the initiative and gave them sufficient support and commitment to concluding the mission that NATO can take credit for it. I want NATO to take credit for this mission, and I want that to be legitimate credit. So that's part of the judgment that this is the right thing to do. The president is using resources sparingly, but he's using resources that NATO really can't use. They don't have those resources. And ISR, the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, the unmanned drones used sparingly, the kind of communications and logistics capability that we are providing, refueling tankers and so on, NATO can't do that. We can. And unless we do, NATO's mission will not be successful, and is very much in our national security interest for NATO's mission to be successful.
Good enough. Okay, Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you having been on the show today. Congressman Jim Moran represents Virginia's 8th District, and he spoke with me from Washington. Thank you, Congressman.
Time.
Jack Goldsmith, I want to give you a quick opportunity to respond to Congressman Moran's complaint that your principled stand now is not consistent with your service under the Bush administration.
That's simply untrue. I have no idea what he's referring to, but it's just not true. The only point I'm making now is not that the war was unlawful from the start. I've written that the president had the authority to initiate this. The point is that he's the first president to clearly blow through the limitations on the War Powers Resolution.
Mm-hmm. 100 days as of yesterday.
Right.
And Julian Zelizer, I wanted to get you, you've written, I think, eloquently about what are the good practical reasons for Congress. You know, we do hear a lot about Congress being somewhat feckless on some issues, but you have written that actually Congress serves an important purpose in having a voice on whether and how we go to war.
Absolutely. The deliberative
nature of Congress and the fact that it's more open than the executive branch, I think, is healthy. The kinds of battles we see in Congress over war and peace are more visible, and they are a bit slower than what takes place in the executive branch. And sometimes decision-making can benefit from a lack of total speed, and I think that function of Congress is very important. And the electoral pressure that members, especially in the House, face has a healthy function. You know, representative from District X has to think about what the cost of a war will be to the constituents they see when they return, who they know much better than a president who's looking just at a national map. There's a constitutional reason we don't have a monarchy. And finally, I think what Jack said earlier, if the president is forced to win over to court Congress and ultimately win their support early on, it creates a stronger sense of mission nationally than if a president just makes this decision unilaterally. So there's many reasons, there are many reasons that Congress needs to be integrated into this process and why we can't just say we're in an age of presidential power and we should live with it.
Jack, all sounds all well in theory, but what is the national security atmosphere like in an administration? I mean, I would think that you have to make really quick decisions and you have a sense that time is not on your side. Is that right?
You often do have to make very quick decisions. And I believe from the newspaper stories that the decision to go into Libya was made very quickly and it was viewed as a crisis situation and that there was a crisis need for humanitarian intervention. And one can understand, even if one doesn't support humanitarian intervention, how the president might have struck that balance the way he did. What's difficult to understand, especially given this president and the way he campaigned about unilateral wars and respect for Congress, mm-hmm. what's difficult to understand is not the original decision to engage in humanitarian intervention, but the decision basically not to go to Congress and seek its approval early on, because he could have gotten it, as I said.
Julian, do you think he could have gotten it?
I think he could have gotten it, yes. I think rather early on there was some or general support for this, and he'd made a decision not to win that over. And I'm not sure why he did that, but I do think he could have received support. Congress usually goes along early on in operations like this. There isn't a long record of resistance in the initial phases.
Okay, let's hear what Susan has to say on this issue. She's calling us from Stowe, Vermont. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I agree with the previous speakers, except for the last one. I think that Congress at this point is actually just rude to the president, not respectful in terms of the Republicans just saying no to anything he wants. He didn't have the opportunity to get the support of the Congress quickly because they are being so obstructive. And he is our commander-in-chief, and I think that we have to believe that he is doing what he needs to do in the best interests of the country. I've been hearing on TV senators making statements about their personal opinions about things in regard to other things besides war, but they're not thinking about what their constituents want for them. They're thinking about what they want, you know, and what benefits them politically. And if they were thinking about their constituents, they would make different choices.
All right. Thank you very much, Susan. Julian, do you think that this issue has come up only because this war, this intervention has not gone well? I mean, if in fact President Obama really thought it was going to be a matter of days, not weeks, then the need to go to Congress would have been a lot less apparent at that time. Maybe this is more about the way this intervention has gone than about anything larger than that.
Well, there were many warnings as this unfolded in the first few weeks that this could take a lot longer than they were saying. I mean, I don't think many members of the administration are in total shock that this wasn't a quick victory. And you can look back at the media and the newspapers of the time and find that kind of criticism. And if the questions were there, if the ambiguity was there, there is reason then to go to Congress, when they had the chance to get that approval. All missions look like they're going to be quick and easy, and they usually aren't. That's the nature of war. That's the fog of war. And so I'm not sure that justification, you know, holds.
Right.
And it doesn't justify what they've done.
Jack, very quick final thought.
Well, this, as I said earlier, the important point here is that courts are not going to limit the presidency. Only the Congress can stand up to the presidency. And the question, the big constitutional question today is whether it can organize itself and whether it has the interest to do so.
Jack Goldsmith is professor of law at Harvard University. He was an assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel from 2003 to 2004, and before that, a special counsel in the Department of Defense. He writes for the blog Lawfare, and he's the author of The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. Julian Zelizer, who joined us from New York, is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He writes a weekly column for CNN.com, and he's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Thank you both gentlemen very much.
Thank you.
We also heard from Congressman Jim Moran from Virginia, and before that from Nancy Youssef, who is a Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You can continue this conversation about war powers and Libya and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio and leave us your thoughts there. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.